Okay, so I think maybe it's time to get started. So first of all, I'd like to again welcome you to the first Enterprise Water Optimization Seminar this semester. And today especially we have the great pleasure of having Professor John Hooker, who's going to give us a seminar on recent developments in integrated methods for optimization. Now, I know that, of course, you know, Professor Hooker is well-known, but most of you here in the audience and maybe also the ones who are listening, but just in case, I thought maybe I should mention a few things about him. So first of all, Professor Hooker has sort of the unusual situation that he has two PhDs, one PhD in philosophy and one PhD in operations research, and that's has sort of led to some very nice, you know, combination of ideas, and that's why I think in many ways he's done some outstanding contributions in the area of logic-based optimization. Professor Hooker is also the Jerome Holleran Professor of Business Ethics in Tepper, because it turns out, aside from the work he does on optimization, he's also very much involved both in ethics and especially some very interesting work he's done on cross-cultural type of work. And if you go to his website, he has really some extremely interesting material there if you want to know how to deal with, for example, business in different parts of the world. But today he's going to wear the sort of operations research hat. And one of the areas that has been of interest, of course, in this group has been to develop both planning and scheduling models in which you try to combine both, on the one hand, mixed integer programming, and on the other hand, constrained programming. So what John is going to give us is sort of an update of that work. He's actually produced a second edition of his book on integrated methods that maybe, well, he's going to make a reference to. So, John, welcome.
Good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, depending on where you are. If you're listening in. Greetings from Pittsburgh. It's a beautiful day here. Blue sky. We don't get too many of those in Pittsburgh. So I'm here to talk to you about what's going on in the world of integrated or hybrid methods for optimization. And this area of research is based on the idea that the different communities who work on optimization are actually dealing with ideas that have an underlying unity. There's a lot of the same ideas going along, although they do emphasize different sides of the issue. And for that reason, there's some value in combining these ideas to work in a single unified solver. And I think the community is moving in that direction, perhaps not as quickly as I would like, but I'm going to try to tell you about what's going on. I should say, by the way, that I'm going to focus on integrating math programming with constraint programming. But the ideas I'm presenting here apply more generally. They apply to global optimization. You can integrate that in the same under the same umbrella. And something I'm working on recently is heuristic methods. It turns out that heuristic methods are actually very similar at a deep level to exact methods, at least in my view. And you can exploit that, perhaps to design algorithms that are neither exact nor heuristic, but it depends on how you twist the dials and the knobs to obtain an exact solution or an approximate solution. Okay, so this is the outline. By the way, Ignacio, how long do the talks usually?
Yeah, here you say up to 1 hour.
So okay.
Yeah, 50 minutes.
50 minutes will be fine.
Yeah, by the way, maybe one thing we might want to check, because Mark Dyken from Air Force is in the midst of that. He was not here.
Okay, can everyone hear me now? Do we have a problem? Hello, hello?
It's not muted, right? Or yes, hello. Is anybody out there? Yes, hello.
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, yeah. You can all hear us. Okay. All right. So, Mark. Sorry.
Okay. So we'll proceed with the outline. So I'm going to begin with a brief introduction to constraint programming, because I know that constraint programming is not well known in the engineering world. Then after that, I'm going to show you some of the major paradigms people are using to combine operations research methods with constraint programming. There are three main approaches, which I'll talk about. I'll also talk about some of the software that's out there and a number of the applications to which people are which people find appropriate for this type of approach. And I'm going to wrap up with some very recent work that I'm involved in. Okay, as I should say, by the way, that I'm going to show you a lot of technical detail as we go along, but it's not necessary to follow all of this. This is a high-level talk. I want to show you what it looks like, what the formalism looks like and everything, but I'm focusing on the big ideas and not the details. So don't worry if you don't follow everything. So moving on to...
I couldn't get on here. I got it on this phone.
Okay. Seem to have some problems with hearing. I'll wait just a moment to make sure we're set.
Yes, hello. It's, can you tell me if you can hear us, please? Yes, hello.
James. I can hear you on the on this phone, on the toll phone. Toll free doesn't work.
Oh, toll free does not work. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Allentown.
Allentown.
Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Should we redial again? Yeah. You know what? We're going to redial just to make sure that everybody's hopefully correctly connected. Okay. So, Bruno, how do we turn this off?
Welcome to the Conference Calling Center. At any time during this message, please enter your participant passcode followed by the pound sign. Your passcode has been confirmed. If you need technical assistance during your call, press star zero. If you are the leader, please press star now. Please enter your meter passcode followed by the pound sign. After the tone, please state your name, followed by the pound sign.
Ignacio Grossman.
There are four parties in conference, including you.
Okay. Can you all hear us? Yes, hello. Hello, can you... Is everybody out there? Anybody out there?
Yes, here's Mark from Air Products.
Okay, sorry. Okay, can you hear us now?
Now I can, yes.
Okay, sorry. Well, we'll continue. I apologize for the problem here.
Okay, so why don't we move ahead? I hope everyone could hear. I'll begin with a brief introduction to constraint programming and what it's all about, how it works. The basic idea of constraint programming is that it's an alternative to optimization solvers, but it has the unique feature that every line of your model is viewed not only as a constraint, but as a procedure. So every line of the model is actually executed by the solver. So it's a kind, it's a combination of computer programming and mathematical programming. So what the procedure does essentially is something called filtering and constraint propagation. So every variable in the problem has a domain, a set of values that it can take. For each constraint, the solver looks to see which of those values can occur in some feasible solution of that constraint. And if a value cannot occur in any feasible solution of that constraint, it throws out that value, or it filters it out. And it reduces the variable domains in that fashion. Then those smaller domains are passed on to the next constraint, where the same type of filtering is used. Now, the advantage of this approach is that you can exploit the structure of each constraint in the problem. In fact, the constraints tend not to be little inequality constraints like we use in math programming. They tend to be global constraints, that is to say, constraints that, for example, may say you're scheduling jobs that can't overlap, constraints with a great deal of content. And as a result, you can exploit the structure of these constraints so as to filter the domains more effectively. So there's a natural way in constraint programming to exploit the substructure the microstructure of a problem and make the most of what you know about the problem. Because your choice of constraints tells the solver what the structure of the problem is, as opposed to, say, integer programming, where you simply write a long list of inequality constraints, and the solver knows very little about the structure of the problem, and so it really can't take advantage of it. So it simply applies everything it knows to it, hoping to hit it lucky. Okay, so that's what the basic idea is in constraint programming. So what I'd like to do is first show you some of the initial successes. For example, the container port in Singapore is scheduled by constraint programming. It's one of the big initial applications of that technique. It's the largest container port in the world. Some other early applications here on slide 8 include circuit design and control of electrical grids. And on slide 9, I have a list of some other applications. I'm going to show you in a moment a simple example of a staff scheduling, a nurse scheduling problem, which is quite realistic because the Hong Kong hospital system uses constraint programming to schedule their staff. And we're talking about thousands of staff here. Some further applications in production scheduling on slide 10. Most of these applications have to do with scheduling, which is the strong point of constraint programming. It's really good at scheduling, usually better than integer programming techniques, because in scheduling problems, the relaxations that are so important to integer programming tend to be weak, whereas the inference methods tend to work well in scheduling problems, and that's the strength of constraint programming. So here's a small example to give you the flavor of what a constraint programming model looks like. This is on slide 11. We're scheduling four nurses, and there's some rules about how we schedule them. They have to work a certain number of days a week. We don't want to have too many different nurses on a given shift. You can see there on slide 11 the scheduling rules. Okay, so we're going to try to write this up as a model. So on the next slide, there are two ways to look at this problem. One is to assign nurses to shifts, and the other is to assign shifts to nurses. And I'm showing you here one possible solution of the problem. Now, in integer programming, you have to pick one or the other. You have to pick one of these variable systems or the other. In constraint programming, you can actually use both simultaneously, which is one of the strengths of constraint programming. It's very good at modeling in different ways. So in the next slide, slide 13, I'm going to show you how to write the constraints. So let's introduce a variable, W, that indicates which nurse is assigned to shift S on a given day. Okay, so it's a discrete variable. And we want to require that each shift during the day gets a different nurse. So we use an all-different constraint for that. It's a standard constraint in constraint programming. We write that constraint. And you can write this using disequalities or inequalities or something with integer variables, but it's really quite awkward to do that. You can use a single all-diff constraint. We want to require that each nurse works at least 5 days a week. So we use a cardinality constraint, which counts the number of times a given value occurs in a set of variables. Okay, the standard constraint. We want to require that at most two nurses work a given shift during the week. There's a constraint for that. It's called n values, which counts the number of different values a set of variables takes. Okay. Now, the rest of the constraints are difficult to express using the variable that I just introduced. So we introduce the opposite variable, which is the shift that's assigned to a given nurse, the Y variable. This is on slide 16. First we can write a constraint that says that each shift gets a different nurse. We've already said that, but there's no harm in repeating ourselves. In fact, it improves the solution. Next slide, the stretch constraint requires that if you work a night shift, you work it at least 2 days in a row. So the stretch constraint looks at stretches of days of which you assign a given employee to a given shift and constrains the length of that stretch. It's a standard constraint again. So all these constraints I'm showing you are filtered by specialized algorithms. So for example, for this stretch constraint, there's a very efficient specialized dynamic programming algorithm that filters the domains of the Y variables based on the structure of that constraint. There's also a pattern constraint here that requires that you don't switch your shift without taking a day off in between. Okay. And finally, we link the two variable systems using something called channeling constraints, which is standard procedure in constraint programming. So, for example, on slide 19, you see the first constraint. This says that the nurse assigned to the shift to which you assign nurse I is nurse I. Got that? And the second constraint says that the shift to which you assign the nurse to which you assign shift S is shift S. Okay, so it links those variables. These constraints are filtered and propagated like all the others, and they actually accelerate the solution of the problem. So there's a little example of what a constraint programming problem looks like. On slide 20, you see the entire model. If you try to write this within integer programming, you get several pages of constraints. So you get a more succinct model that sort of reveals the structure of the problem through the solver. Okay. Another example. This is on slide 21. Very powerful constraint that really is one key to the success of this field is resource constraint scheduling. It's called the cumulative scheduling constraint. And basically this constraint says if you have a number of jobs, you want to assign them to a facility or to a shop and schedule them in such a way that at any one time you don't exceed the resources available. So, for example, perhaps each job requires a certain number of workers. You want to schedule the jobs so that at any one time you have enough workers to handle all the jobs in process. This is a very versatile constraint. A special case is disjunctive scheduling, where you have one facility that takes one job at a time, and that's the classical one-machine scheduling problem. Okay, so to take a little example, this is from the IBM OPL manual, which is one of the constraint programming systems out there. We're going to load items on a ship. Okay, it takes a certain time to load each item on the ship and a certain number of workers to lift it. Okay, we want to know when to load each item, how to schedule the loading so as to minimize make span, that is the total time required to load the ship. And because of this, the configuration of the ship, there are precedence constraints on slide 23 that govern how, in what order you can load the items. Perhaps the big ones have to go on first or whatever. Okay, so we have these constraints. Now to find the schedule, you write the problem shown on slide 24. We're minimizing the make span. The TIs are the time at which you load job I, time you start loading it. And the cumulative constraint simply requires that you have enough workers at any one time out of the eight to do all the active jobs in process at that time. So you notice you can model this problem with no integer variables, no 0-1 variables. None of that is required. You simply use the variables that are intuitively part of the problem, namely the loading time of each job. That's all you need. All right, so now let me show you, just to give you a little glimpse of the guts of what's going on in a constraint programming solver. This is on slide 25. I'm going to show you how a cumulative constraint is filtered, or at least show you one method, the simplest method for filtering these. So here we have a little problem where we have three jobs, and the start time of job I is SI. And on the left here, we have a table showing the processing time and resource requirements of each job, as well as the time window within which it has to take place. In the picture on the right, there is a Gantt chart showing a feasible schedule. So the horizontal axis here is time, where the time windows are indicated on the bottom. The vertical axis is the rate of resource consumption, and the dotted line at the top is the maximum resource available. So you see each box here represents the processing of a job, and the total resource consumption rate at any one time is within the maximum. Okay, so that's a feasible solution of the problem. Okay. Now what we want to do is to take this constraint and try to restrict the domains of the variables, that is to say, shrink the time windows within which a job can start based on the reasoning in this problem. So the next slide, well, the way this is done is to look at the so-called energy required to process each job. The energy is the duration of the job times the resource consumption rate. You can think of the resource consumption as kilowatts. Okay, so the total energy is the product of those two. And we can prove, for example, that job three has to finish after the other two jobs in this case. So how can we prove that? Well, what you do is you look at the energy required by all the jobs. This is on slide 26, and on the left here, the sum of the two E's is the total energy required, okay? And the energy available is on the right. The energy available is the maximum energy consumption rate, C, okay, times the energy between, on the next slide it shows, the energy between the earliest start time of all the jobs and the latest end time of jobs 1 and 2, because we're going to assume here that job 3 can't finish last and drive a contradiction. So if we assume that, we're going to get a contradiction. And on the next slide, slide 28, that means that the jobs all have to be done by the latest finish time of jobs 1 and 2, which is inside that red box. But there's not enough energy, not enough area inside that red box to accommodate all three jobs. Therefore, job 3 must finish after the other two finish. So this is called edge finding, cumulative edge finding. Now, what do we do with this fact? Now we've deduced that job 3 has to finish after the other guys. We're going to use this fact to update the bounds on when the jobs can start. So on the next slide, slide 29, what we're going to do here, now energy, this is a little bit hard to follow. Don't worry about it, but let's give it to you quickly. What's going on here is we're going to leave space at the top of this diagram, a band 2 units wide at the top, which is the space required by job 3. Okay, we're going to schedule job 3 inside that space somewhere. And we look and see how much energy is left to schedule the other two jobs. There are 10 units left in the space below that. So we're going to put jobs 1 and 2 down there. They don't quite fit. There's 10 units, 4 units left over. So since job 3 is last, that means we're going to have to use at least the first 2 time units for jobs 1 and 2, and job 3 must start no earlier than time 2 if it's going to fit. Okay, so that's the reasoning. Okay, you can go back over this at home, perhaps. And so you see the equation above here. The earliest start time of job 3 is given by this expression. Okay. On slide 32, you see the general formula. You run this calculation for every subset of jobs. Okay, and there's an exponential number of subsets of jobs. But if you're really clever, you can actually do all the calculations in quadratic time. Okay, the algorithm is really quite complicated, but it runs really fast. So this is so-called cumulative edge finding. And on slide 34, you see a list of some of the other techniques used for this type of constraint: extended edge finding, timetabling, not first, not last rules, and something called energetic reasoning. These are all different techniques that shrink the domain of the start time variables and allow you to solve the problem more quickly because the domains are now smaller and there's less branching required to solve the problem. Okay. So that's a little glimpse inside the guts under the hood of a constraint programming solver. Now, on slide 35, I've tried to contrast constraint programming with math programming. So you see, constraint programming is strong in logic processing and inference, whereas in math programming is strong in numerical calculation. Constraint programming relies on filtering and strength propagation inference techniques as opposed to relaxation, which is very important in math programming, with cutting planes and so forth. The modeling is very different. You model with high-level constraints as opposed to atomistic inequalities. Both methods solve the problem by branching. Okay, so we have a point of commonality there. Now, people often complain, well, constraint programming, the model is not solver independent because you have to implement something for each type of constraint that appears in the model. Well, that's true, yes. But actually, you take advantage of that fact because now the solver knows the structure of the model. And furthermore, you know, if you write down an integer programming model, you're going to have to think about the solution method there as well, or it won't solve. You have to choose the right variables, you know, get rid of the symmetry, you know, the right branching method, you know, use, you know, maybe type 1 SOS or whatever. You know, so when you, even in integer programming, you don't have independence of model and solver. In constraint programming, you take advantage of this lack of independence. Okay, so on page, on slide 36, these are some constraint programming solvers that are out there. Eclipse is the oldest one, but it's still maintained. It's free. CHIP and the OPL solver are commercial solvers. You have to pay for them. Although IBM, if you're an academic user, you can get an IBM free academic license and load and download all of their solvers for free. So I use them for free. You can do the same. G-Code is a state-of-the-art toolkit for constraint programming. It's free. You can add into your Excel spreadsheet. There's a CP solver for Excel made by Frontline Systems. you have to pay for that one. There's a group out at Monash University, NICTA, is developing a gigantic constraint programming and hybrid solver system called G12. Okay. And as of recently, there is a Google CP solver. If you look up Google OR tools, you will find their CP solver, which is open source. All right, now integration. How does that work? Okay, so I'm going to begin with complementary strengths and then show you three paradigms for integrating constraint programming and math programming.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, question, yes.
For constraint programming, are you talking about filtering the domain of individual variables or the joint domain of the vector?
Okay, so the question was, in constraint programming, do you filter individual variable domains, or do you filter joint, you know, Cartesian product of domains? Okay, so all of the existing commercial solvers filter individual variable domains. However, my colleagues and I are working on something that goes beyond that. We're filtering the Cartesian product using binary decision diagrams. So in principle, you can go beyond it, but the commercial solvers don't.
So the commercial ones restrict the domain so you don't have to search as much, but there are still infeasible combinations of the domain.
Yes. Even if you filter each variable domain as much as possible, this is called domain consistency. Still, there are some Cartesian products in there that are not feasible. Absolutely. So this is why branching is necessary. Yeah. So on slide 38, a comparison. CP is strong at inference and modeling. It does exploit the local structure, and as I mentioned, its scheduling is a strong point, whereas OR methods tend to have good relaxation, cutting planes, Lagrangian relaxation, very elegant, beautiful duality theory, which is useful. They tend to be more robust. So the complaint with CP, very often, you know, if the problem is not too big up to a certain point, it really runs fast, it's really great, but if it passes a critical threshold, it blows up. Okay, it tends to lack robustness. I'm going to show you an example of that later. And, of course, OR is very strong on continuous optimization. Okay. So rather than, you know, agonize about which is better, why not put these two guys together and let them combine their strengths? This is what we're going to do. So on slide 39, this is an outline of the three approaches. And the first approach is very simple. Basically, when you solve a problem by branching, rather than simply solve the relaxation to get a bound, you also do propagation and filtering in CP style at each node of the tree. So in the next slide, slide 41, here is a branching tree for integer programming problem, shown on the left there, and I added a few cutting planes, knapsack cuts to the problem. So at each node of the tree, you see the green indicates the domains of the variables. So I'm using filtering methods to reduce those domains every time I branch. Every time I branch, I restrict a variable, and that allows me to reduce domains. And I also solve the linear relaxation in the usual way, like you do in IP solvers, and get a solution of the relaxation shown by the x equal whatever, and the resulting bound. So you can use the bound and branch and bound, this is usual. And you can also prune the tree by filtering. So, for example, if you look at the leftmost node, the upper left, where it says infeasible, there we were able to filter all the domains to the empty set. Didn't even have to solve the relaxation. So if you're using standard IP methods, you would have to keep branching here because you would get a fractional solution. You have to branch again and again and again. But if you add to that relaxation mechanism, a filtering mechanism, you know you can prune the tree right there. Okay, so why not? That's a very simple idea. Just combine the two at each node. And this is what you get. So that's the idea. And on slide 43, I'll show you, for example, how you relax. So the cumulative constraint I showed you a while ago, the scheduling constraint, you can relax it by writing a mixed integer model for that constraint. And on this page is what the mixed integer model looks like. So you introduce 0-1 variables simply for the purposes of relaxation. You put these constraints into a relaxation. You don't branch on the integer variables. You just branch on the original variables. But you introduce the integer variables to relax the problem. And for each constraint, you throw into the pool of relaxed constraints its contribution. So these constraints would go into a pool of relaxed constraints that's used to compute a bound for the entire problem. Okay. And on the next page, 44, this is another type of relaxation for cumulative. It doesn't introduce zero and variables, even your valid cutting planes. There's some theory here. Okay, so there are a number of ways to relax these global constraints. All right. Another technique that's related, this is on slide 45, you have piecewise linear functions, because it's a very useful technique, right, to use piecewise linear. If you have a nonlinear function, you can approximate it with piecewise linear. Now, generally speaking, people deal with piecewise linear by introducing 0-1 variables. Right? You introduce SOS2 constraints or various types of 0-1 modeling techniques for this piecewise linear. You don't have to do any of that. Okay, what you can do, for example, if you have the piecewise linear function showed here, in fact, it's not only piecewise linear, it's discontinuous. Okay, it's a really nasty function. All you have to do is compute the convex hull of this graph. Okay, so you see the dotted area here is the convex hull. You can compute this convex hull in practically zero time. You know, very fast algorithms for this, been known for a long time. Then you add the facets of this convex hull to your relaxation. So this describes approximately the piecewise linear function. You get a relaxation of that function. Okay? Now, when you branch, so suppose you, on the next slide, suppose you solve a relaxation and you get a value for x, which is the argument of the function here, that's sort of in between, that green dot there. Okay? Well, you branch on the two segments of the function, and this allows you to tighten up the relaxation. Okay? So if on the left side, for example, now you have an exact representation of that part of the function, and it's tighter on the right side. So the more you branch, the tighter the relaxation gets. Okay, so this simple little trick alone will allow you, you know, to speed up the solution by a factor of 100 over C-plex. A simple trick like this. You get rid of the integer variables. Okay. And in the meantime, you can filter the variable x and, you know, reduce the bounds, which I've done here as well. Okay. All right, so that's a very simple idea. So on slide 47, I have some computational results in the literature. I'll take you through some of these. So the second one there is the technique I just talked about. Okay, you get big speed up. Now people will say, you know, some of these results I'm showing you, you know, are based on comparisons with the C-plex of 10 years ago. The C-plex is 100 times, 1,000 times faster now. Well, that's true. The standard solvers are getting faster all the time, but the integrated methods are getting faster all the time too. Okay. So they both improve. So the point I'm trying to make is, if we are going to invest so much into engineering these solvers, such as Gurobi and C-plex or ExpressMP, why not engineer integrated solvers with all this effort? You know, invest this effort in an integrated solver so that we get, you know, better performance all along, rather than restrict ourselves to one particular method. Okay. Next slide, there's a few more results from the literature, and next slide, some more. The one on top is actually a nonlinear structural design problem. An application I like is the last one, radiation therapy planning, uses Lagrangian relaxation along with CP techniques. Very nice application. Okay, and on slide 50, I have a few more applications of this particular type of integration. I'll just let you scan those. The one at the bottom, the boat party scheduling, was actually the first problem solved by hybrid methods. So there's a famous problem in the literature attacked by several people. It turned out that the linear relaxation of this problem has an optimal value. That's the optimal value of the original problem. So you get a tight bound right up front. You just have to get a feasible solution. So CP provided the feasible solution, and math programming provided the bound to prove optimality. Next page, you see a few more applications. And a few more on slide 52. This is all using the same technique, combining relaxation with propagation. Okay, so now we go into branch and price. Can I quickly tell you about that? This is another technique out there in the literature. Now, branch and price is a well-known technique in operations research. Basically, you solve an integer programming problem that's formulated so as to have millions of variables. So you have like a variable for every combinatorial solution. The classical application is aircraft crew scheduling, right? In fact, the airlines use Branch and Price to schedule their crews. They're using them today. This is what they do. And the way it works is, for every possible way you might assign a crew to a sequence of flights, you have a variable. Then the variable is 1 if you decide to use that particular schedule or color roster for that crew, and it's 0 otherwise. And of course, there are millions of ways, right, to string together a sequence of flights to assign a crew, maybe in a 24-hour period. So you have millions of variables. Now, these sequences, these rosters, are governed by very complicated rules, you know, work rules and union rules and so forth, safety rules to make sure that the pilots or the crew is not overworked. So you have a problem where you have millions of variables, but when you formulate the problem this way, it gets rid of the symmetry. And symmetry is the bugaboo, is the really problem, the big problem in these models. Okay, and you solve it by column generation. So basically the way it works is that, you know, you solve the problem by branching as usual integer programming, and at each node of the search tree, you solve a linear relaxation of that huge integer programming problem. But you solve it by column generation. You start with only a few of the variables, and you bring in new variables as they are needed based on the reduced costs. And those new variables are generated by a subproblem called the pricing problem that generates a variable with negative reduced cost. Okay, so I'm assuming you've perhaps seen this at some point back in your background. Now, the only difference in CP-based branch and price is that the pricing problem, the column generation, is done by constraint programming rather than by some other heuristic that's used. And the rationale is that, well, if you have very complicated rules for generating flight rosters, for example, then constraint programming is really good at complicated constraints. Okay, in fact, the more complicated the constraints, the better, because it reduces the domains more, right? You throw in a lot of extra messy constraints, constraint programming solvers just love that, because it allows them to reduce the domains. So CP is good at handling these complicated constraints for column generation. So I'll show you an example. This is an airline crew scheduling example on slide 54. So we have some constraints on how these flights can be strung together to form a roster. You can't have too big a gap between them, and the overall work time is restricted, and so forth. Okay. So on the next slide, this is what the integer programming problem looks like. So we have a variable xij, okay? This takes the value 1 if you assign crew I, roster j. There's various, and these patterns of 1s and 0s indicate the flights that occur in each roster. Then we have constraints to make sure that each crew member is assigned to a roster and to make sure that each flight gets a crew. So the details aren't too important here, but that's basically what it looks like. The next slide, this shows you one example, flight 1. See, slide 57, it defines the cost at the top of the matrix, the cost for each assignment. We're trying to minimize cost. Okay, the next slide shows how we start. We start with a subset of the columns, okay? We solve the linear relaxation and generate a dual solution, which are the U's and the V's on the right-hand side there inside the green, okay? And the dual solutions are used to compute the reduced cost of the other columns. Okay, and on slide 60, this is the objective function on the right there, the objective function of the pricing problem, which is the reduced cost of the new column we're going to bring in. So we try to find a variable with negative reduced cost to bring into the problem and improve the solution of the linear relaxation. So on the next slide, this is how it's done in this particular case. We formulate the pricing problem as a shortest path problem in a graph. Okay, so this graph on slide 61, basically each path through the graph on the next slide indicates a possible roster, okay, that obeys all the constraints. Each number there in the graph, on the nodes of the graph, are flights. And the path indicates how you string these flights together to form a schedule for that particular crew. Now, the costs on the arcs are the cost of staffing each flight with the crew. Okay, and those costs are offset by the U's and the V's, which are the dual variables in the master problem. And the difference is the reduced cost. So the reduced cost of a roster, the green roster there, if you go on a couple of slides, slide 66, those red numbers are the are the net, the off the net cost of each assignment taking into account the reduced cost. And the length of a path is the reduced cost of that particular variable. So we're looking for a path with negative length to get a reduced cost. So we solve a shortest path problem. And if we find a negative path, then we have a new variable to add to the master problem. In this case, we have a new variable for each crew member. Okay, so that's column generation. Now, this is a constraint programming problem here because there are constraints on these paths. In particular, the total flight time of each roster is restricted. So it's not simply a shortest path problem. The shortest path is subject to constraints. So on slide 68, I formulate that problem as a constraint programming problem. It's using a global constraint called the path constraint. Okay? And it's using set-valued variables, which is a very nice feature of constraint programming modeling. You can have variables that represent sets. In this case, sets of flights. Okay? So the pricing problem then is solved by constraint programming so as to find a negative reduced cost variable. Okay? So that's the basic idea. Now, you can use this same basic idea to solve, say, a process scheduling problem on the next slide, 69. Okay, so it's basically the same idea. Rather than having, crews to flights, you assign batches to processing units. Okay, same idea. Of course, here you have to schedule when the processing starts. So you actually have, rather than just flights that start at a particular time, you have units at which processing can start at many different times. So the unit here, you have unit slash start times. So on the next slide, you see the master problem, the integer programming model. The variable indicates, this is xij, is 1. If we assign batch I to a particular schedule, and a schedule consists of a sequence of processing stages on particular units at particular times. So of course, there are millions of different ways to sequence, to sequence together these processing stages. But again, we use column generation. We only have to look at a small fraction of the possible sequences and generate them by constraint programming. And on the next slide, well, this graph now, rather than chaining flights together, we chain together stages, processing stages. And each node on the graph represents a unit and a start time for a processing stage. And we look for a negative reduced cost path. Okay. So this is a way to apply the same idea to process scheduling, one particular process scheduling problem. Okay. On the next slide, 72, are some results, computational results in the literature for this type of application. It's not so much faster than traditional branch and price for airline problems. It's just that it allows you to accommodate the work rules more easily. Very complicated. In fact, at one point I was at Heathrow and I sat on the runway in a plane for several hours while the company tried to figure out if the plane could still leave at that late hour without violating the work rules. It actually took the company hours to figure it out. They're so complicated. And the next slide is a list of applications for branch and price, CP-based branch and price. My colleague Mike Trick has applied this to sports scheduling. Okay. So he's into baseball scheduling. Okay. So when they play a home game in Pittsburgh with the Pirates, it comes out of Mike's schedule. Actually, they don't actually use his schedule, I understand, but it's a shadow. It shadows the actual scheduling technique that they use for comparison. Okay, finally, there are decomposition methods on slide 74. These use a generalization of Bender's cuts and decomposes the problem into a master problem, for example, that may do planning or assignment of jobs, and a subproblem that does scheduling. So this is a way we can exploit the strengths of MIP, for mixed integer programming, for planning and assignment, and exploit the strength of CP for scheduling. So I'll show you a little example on the next slide, 75. We're going to assign jobs to facilities. So, for example, you can think about an auto manufacturing company that assigns cars to manufacturing plants. We decide which plant to manufacture each car in. This is actually done by Peugeot They use this method I'm going to show you to schedule their manufacturing plants. And once you assign cars to each assembly line in a plant, then you have to schedule, you have to sequence those cars on the assembly line. And all these cars have different requirements. You know, some have sunroofs, some have air conditioning. You have to schedule them very carefully to make sure the workers can keep up, you know, with the requirements as the car moves along the assembly line. Okay. So the master problem here is to assign the cars to the assembly lines. You solve that by mixed integer programming. Because MIP is very good at assignment problems. It has very strong relaxations. It does great. And the subproblem is scheduling and sequencing the cars on the line, which, for which we use constraint programming. Okay. Then we generate a Bender's cut from that sequence, from that sequencing in each for each assembly line that goes back into the master problem, just like in classical Bender's decomposition. Okay, so in the next slide, you see the one possible Bender's cut if you're minimizing makespan. I want to explain where this comes from, but basically it's a logical analysis of the scheduling problem and its solution. Okay. It's like solving a dual of the scheduling problem. You look at the proof of optimality, and from that you derive a Bender's cut. Just like in classical Bender's, you look at the dual solution of the subproblem that proves optimal, that proves optimality, and derive a Bender's cut from that. And on the next slide, say 77, you see the master problem that contains the Bender's cuts along with the relaxation of the subproblem. So this is the basic idea. And on the next, slide 78, there are some computational results out there. In some cases, it's roughly competitive with MIP. In other cases, it's incredibly faster. So we've actually seen cases where CPLEX will run all day, and we can solve the problem in less than a second, okay, if we're lucky. Depends on the instance. Okay. Next slide is a few more. And next slide, a few more. I'm going to tell you about the single facility scheduling in just a moment. Okay, and a few more applications are on slide 81. This is Bender space decomposition methods. A very nice application at the bottom is computer process scheduling. You're scheduling processors in a computing environment to do various parts of the problem. It turns out to be a very nice application for decomposition. You assign computational tasks to the processors, then you schedule the task on each processor so it decomposes naturally. And a few more on the next slide. So I'm going to show you some references in a moment, which you can use to track down all of these citations that I'm giving you on the slide. You can find out more about each of these applications. Now, okay, what kind of software do we have to implement integrated methods? Okay, well, this is a moving target. Okay, so the first one was Eclipse. It was a CP solver that also included some integrated methods. It's a little bit old now. You know, it's a fairly limited integration. Now, I often use IBM's OPL Studio to integrate. You can solve using CP solver or using a MIP solver, depending on which constraints you write. But if you want non-trivial integration, you have to hand code it using their script language. But it's very good for that. So, for example, I use OPL Studio for all of these Bender's hybrids. There's a low-level modeling language called Moselle, which you can use for the same purpose. Here at CMU, we develop a solver, Simple, which actually does all the integration for you. It's all automated, but it's still under development, so we have a lot of work to do. Skip is well known as a mixed integer solver. Actually, it's intended to be a hybrid solver. CIP stands for constraint integer programming, constraint programming and integer programming. So now it's incorporating some CP elements as well, and you can use it for free. And I mentioned the G12, which is a hybrid solver. And global solvers like Baron actually use hybrid methods. You know, so, for example, there are interval propagation techniques in these global solvers, as well as relaxation and convexification techniques. Okay, so they're already hybrid solvers. They have to be have any chance of solving the problems. Okay, so there's a list of software. And to just wrap up some very recent work, one is the decomposition methods sometimes work on problems that don't decompose very naturally. So, for example, suppose you have a single machine scheduling problem with very long time horizon and many, many jobs to schedule. It's a very big problem. The standard methods, you know, blow up on problems this large. Can you decompose this problem by splitting the time horizon into segments, then assigning jobs to each segment? That would be the master problem, and then scheduling the job inside each segment. So we tried that, see what would happen. See if we could, it's a pure scheduling problem. Let's see if we could use a decomposition method here. Well, there's two variations of the problem. In one variation, each segment is like a week, and the jobs have to be done before the weekend. Okay, and the other variation is the jobs can overlap the weekend. So we looked at the second one is a much harder problem. Okay. So on the next slide, slides 86 are some results for the problem where you can't overlap a weekend. You have to get done before the weekend. And as you can see, you know, Benders is beating the heck out of the other state of the art solvers as the problem scales up. So it works very well on those problems. The next slide 87, the different class of instances. Not quite so impressive here, but still we're way ahead of the other guys. Now, what happens if we allow jobs to overlap the weekends on the next slide? Well, here we get mixed results. Okay, these are hard problems because the Bender's cuts are really quite complicated. Long, if you have half a page to write a Bender's cut for this problem. But what happens is if you solve the problem with CP, if the problem's not too big or too nasty, it'll solve it in a snap, in less than a second. If it doesn't solve it, it runs all day. And so it's either 1 second or all day, which is sort of classic behavior for CP. Okay, so we found that when CP works, we can't beat it. It's so fast on these problems. But if it blows up, we can solve it in about 5 seconds while CP is running all day. You know, so here you have a very simple method to integrate. You try CP for 1 second. If it doesn't solve it, you switch over to a Bender's hybrid, and it'll solve it for you. It's guaranteed to solve it. Okay. All right. Some other recent work. I mentioned the all different constraints a while ago. These are very useful constraints for scheduling, and also if you like Sudoku puzzles. You know, that's a multiple all different problem. Okay, so you don't need to solve them yourself. You can just plug it into a CP solver and it'll solve it for you. Okay, so, can you relax those multiple all different constraints? Well, they have a polyhedral structure. Okay. So it turns out that this multiple all diff problem is actually identical to the graph coloring problem, which is usually modeled with 0-1 variable. So it's a classical problem in operations research people have been working on for decades. So what we did was to analyze the polyhedron for the multiple all diff and map the facets of that polyhedron into 0-1 space and put them into the classical 0-1 model for graph coloring. And we get cutting planes that are stronger than all of the known cuts for graph coloring. Not only that, we can get a tighter bound with many fewer cuts. So, for example, we can add maybe 2 cuts that are stronger than thousands of cuts of the traditional type. Okay, so there seems to be some future here for analyzing the polyhedral structure of global constraints. And if you want, you can map those cutting planes into 0-1 space, into the traditional 0-1 model, and get strong cuts. Okay, this is some recent work. Another project I'm working on with some colleagues listed there are binary decision diagrams. Okay, so these have been used for a long time. In fact, they were developed to a great degree here at CMU by Randy Bryant and others. For circuit verification and circuit design. So a binary decision diagram is a compact representation of a Boolean function. But it can also represent the feasible set of an optimization problem. In particular, it can represent a relaxation of that feasible set. So what we are doing is to replace the collection of domains called the domain store in constraint programming solvers with a BDD, a binary decision diagram, which is a more sophisticated data structure that takes into account the interaction of the variable domains. This is the question you asked before. So we carry out filtering and propagation on the BDD. So how does this work? Well, it depends on the problem, but for example, we solve multiple all diff problems this way, and we reduce the search tree from, say, a million nodes to one node just by adding a BDD propagator. And we sped up the solution by a factor of 100 or so. So we're trying this on various problems. And this summer, one of my students, Andre Sire, actually spent some time at Google implementing BDDs in the Google CP solver. So that's the first public implementation of this technique. Okay. And finally, you can use these same BDDs in the next slide, 91, to compute bounds. Rather than using linear relaxation and cutting planes, you can actually just solve the shortest path problem in the BDD to get a bound. So how does that work? So we tried this on one problem, independent set problem, and it turns out we can get tighter bounds than all of the cutting planes you have in CPLEX. Okay, so we turn on CPLEX, let it run like half an hour, an hour, or 2 hours to generate all its cutting planes, and we can get a tighter bound than CPLEX in about a half a second using a BDD, at least on this problem. Now, we don't know about other problems. So this suggests, you might just throw away the linear relaxation and use BDD relaxations at each node of your search tree, depending on problem. It has to be a discrete problem, discrete variables. Okay, that's just very, very recent work. And so basically, here on the last slide, 92, are some references. So the book that Ignacio mentioned has almost all the citations that I mentioned, so you can look them up if you want to follow the work. The other two papers you can download from my website, which are surveys of recent work in hybrid methods. Well, the last paper you can download, the book you can't download, there's only one paper in it. Okay. So that's my talk. So if you have questions. Yeah.
First, are there any questions? Anybody would like to ask a question to Professor John Hooker? They're still there? Well, we don't hear it. It often happens. Yeah, any?
So you mentioned domain filtering for one specific kind of constraints, but if you have two different constraints, are there, like, say you had an all diff constraint and a cumulative constraint in a problem? And when you do domain filtering, just the all diff constraint, you're not using some information, say, from another constraint. And
yes.
So is there a way?
Yeah, so what it has to do is to communicate the results of one domain filter to the next constraint. And that's done just simply by passing along the reduced domains. Okay, so
it's sequential or not?
Yeah, it's done sequentially. Actually, it's done through a fixed point. You cycle through the constraints in a rather sophisticated way and so forth. Yeah, that's the way it's done. Yeah.
So when you do this passing of domains to each constraint, can this be endless? Can it go on and on?
Well, there is a fixed point. It reaches a fixed point.
Okay.
So the issue there is, do you want to take it all the way to the fixed point? And exactly how do you want the constraints to wake up, as you cycle through them? And there's a whole literature on this. And there's all various algorithms, for it. They're called R consistency algorithms. Yeah.
Any other questions? Well, let me ask one question. I think the thing, as you mentioned, the solvers, for example, mixed integer solvers like CPLEX have gotten a lot better, say, over the last 10 years. But I think it's also not fair to say one of the reasons is they've actually already implemented some of the ideas of constraint programming. So in some respect, those, like CPLEX or even Goropy, but I think especially CPLEX have become, to some extent, already some integrated type of software. No, or I don't know, I'm curious
yes,
what your views are.
I always get into trouble if I try to speculate on what is in CPLEX. So I really
right.
should back away from that. But it
right.
may well be true that some constraint programming ideas are in there. Yeah, but I can't give you firsthand
okay.
account of that.
Well, that's, any other? Yeah.
Of the solvers, at least SCIP allows to formulate in the jumping form. If we can formulate a problem in the jumping form, can it further improve the branch and bound, by giving
extra. I think the answer is absolutely yes, because if you have a disjunctive formulation, first you can generate disjunctive cuts, exactly how to generate disjunctive cuts, or even a convex hull
formulation of that disjunction, the convex hull relaxation of it. So yeah, so I think solvers that accept disjunctive formulations, disjunctions of linear systems, for example, have an advantage because you know you have a disjunctive structure there, and then the solver can exploit that. Yeah, in fact, our solver simple allows disjunctions and exploits that structure.
Does that mean the constraint programming actually exploits, or you're talking about just exploiting the structure?
Yeah, the pure CP solvers don't exploit the structure of a disjunction of linear systems because they don't have relaxations. So you have to use the relaxation to exploit the structure. Yeah. You need a hybrid solver.
Okay, any other questions?
Well, with this, again, let me thank very much John Hooker for...
Ignacio.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
Anybody out there?
Hi, John. This is Ian from ABB.
Okay, you're welcome.
Just a quick question about combining MILP with CP. Are there any major advances in the multi-stage case where you have parallel machines?
I'm thinking. I don't know of any offhand.
But I think those you mentioned mainly have single machines per stage.
Yes. Yes, I don't know of any offhand, no.
Okay, still a tough cake.
Yeah,
right, okay. Any other questions out there? Okay, again, well, let me thank again John Hooker for a nice presentation. Thank you. Thank you.